Did you have a background in Middle Eastern affairs?
No, I didn't have any background in Middle Eastern affairs. I was taken into the Foreign Service on the lateral entry program in 1957, and assigned, my first assignment was as financial officer in Iran in 1958. I had no background in the country at all. I started studying about it when I heard about my assignment.
You had background, what was your sort of general background before?
I was in the intelligence and research department, the State Department, and I was working mainly on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, mostly on the economic side.
Your training was an economist?
Not really, no, but I had my work experience with all those economists. My training was the general classic training.
Okay. When you first came to Tehran, the embassy, what were your major duties?
My major duties were to monitor the financial activities of the country, including the budget and the management of financial affairs by the major banks and the Ministry of the Treasury and similar organizations.
Uh-huh. Did those duties change over time? Or?
No, they were about the same. I occasionally had to substitute for people that did other things, such as follow the petroleum industry. We have petroleum attaché off and on, but sometimes we didn't, and I would substitute for him. And I would also sometimes carry on the work of the economic development officer. We were rather well staffed at the time. Mm-hmm. And it fell to my lot, as a matter of fact, to prepare the quarterly economic reports and the quarterly economic summaries, which were analytical pieces about the progress of the economy. As a financial officer, this was just one of my duties. This covered everything. I consulted with other officers and this was a reporting requirement at the time, and no longer is.
Do you prepare those all the way to the Kennedy administration?
No. No. Well, the first 2 years of the Kennedy administration, yes, and then I returned to the State Department, and I was officer in charge of Iranian affairs from 62 to 65, mm-hmm. to the end of the Kennedy administration and the Johnson administration.
We'll go into the foreign economic development matters later, but I thought we might sort of cover sort of how do you characterize the Shah's regime as you saw it when you worked around the early 50s?
I characterize it as fairly tentative at the time I was in Iran. In other words, I found that the Shah had, while he had been restored to his throne after his brief flight in 1963, he was still feeling his way and groping and didn't really have a cohesive philosophy of government, and also felt a little bit weak with regard to the dominant families in Iran. He didn't feel that he could manage them completely.
So were there other core centers of power?
There were other centers of power. There was the clergy all along. That was a center of power. Mm-hmm. And then there were the rich landowning families.
Did you ever meet him?
Only in the most formal sort of a way, at the so-called salons on his birthday and on Iranian, the New Year's.
It was like an official reception.
There were official receptions in which various members of the diplomatic corps went and paid respects to him at the city palace. Mm-hmm. And that's the only time I did not ever have conversations with the Shah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I learned a good deal about conversations with the Shah from the first ambassador who was there when I was there, Tom Wales.
Thomas Wales?
Yes, Edward Key Wales. Mm-hmm. And from Julius Holmes, who was ambassador after Wales.
Well, what kinds of conversations that you had sort of secondhand knowledge of, you're looking at analysis of minutes of conversations, what kind of did you get a sense of what made the Shah tick? Could you get any
thoughts on that? Yes, I felt that he was a man very much impressed with his position and very much obsessed with his role in history. He hired an American you may know about, Wilhelm, to write an autobiography, so to speak, of the Shah, which was called Marhamiyat Baray Vasanam, called Mission for My Fatherland.
Was this American?
Wilhelm was his name. Charles, well, I forget his first name, but he was a man whom we knew while we were in Iran, a man who was impressed with the Shah as a world figure.
Sort of a PR expert or something like that?
No, he was a sort of historian, I believe. Donald Wilhelm was his name. And he wrote this quote, autobiography, unquote, for the Shah, in which the Shah spoke of his mission as he saw it. And he was, at that time, I think, gathering a sort of a sense of messianic mission, doing things, bringing his country into the modern world. And he had a lot of ideas about overcoming backwardness in Iran and bringing Iran, aligning Iran more to Europe than to Asia. He had a sort of a contempt for the Arab world, his Muslim brothers in the Arab world, and a feeling more of kinship, or a desired kinship with European powers. He also had developed over the course of time, this is not so much during my time in Tehran, but during my time as desk officer, he developed a sense of his mission as the foremost military power in the Middle East, particularly at the time of the British withdrawal from east of Suez. He felt that he should be the surrogate in there, and this was conveyed to me when I was around as an officer by the ambassadors at the time.
So he had that sense in the early 60s that was this function.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well before the British withdrawal.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the biggest things which occurred during my time, which I know much less about than legal officers, was the question of Iran's adherence to the CENTO Pact. And this occurred during my time, and this is what caused a tremendously angry reaction from the leader of the Soviet Union, Khrushchev.
Given the development of the CENTO agreement?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And particularly Iran's signing of it after Khrushchev claimed that Iran promised that it would not sign.
Mm-hmm. What year was this?
About 59, I believe, or 60. I can't quite remember. It was not exactly in my field, but it was one of the most striking things that occurred during my time. This is when Khrushchev made the famous right plum speech, saying that at the proper time Iran would fall into his hands like a right plum.
I'll ask you some more questions about that shortly. In terms of the Shah's system, as you said, as people perceived it at the time, as American officials perceived it, did they think that the Shah had broad and positive support for his rule in the late 50s? Was it assumed that there was broad and positive support?
No, I don't think so. I think it was assumed that people went along with the Shah because it was a welcome change from the disruptions that occurred over the oil nationalization crisis. But I don't think that there was any widespread support. It was always assumed that when there were crowds brought out on the streets, they were brought out by promises of free Coca-Cola and stuff like that, that there was no popular enthusiasm particularly for the Shah.
Well, what were the major problems you think in that respect?
Problems?
In terms of lack of support that could be perceived at that time in the late 50s, say?
I think there was a broad sense of grievance already about the ostentatious living style of the Shah and his family and their freedom from accountability. There were a lot of stories rife at the time about the activities of his family, particularly his twin sister Ashraf, and I think that most people believed them.
Mm-hmm. So what is that? Who gave the Shah support? What group, social groups or Australia gave the Shah political support in Iran at this time?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I would presume that it was the powerful classes who felt that he was keeping things under control for them. We're glad that Mossadegh did not prevail. I believe that's probably the case.
That was your question.
Yeah.
The groups that you said had some influence, restrained his power in some way, both land elites and so forth.
Yes, they also restrained his power.
Yeah.
And they, in a sense, kept him from doing things that many of us believe that he really wanted to do, such as land reform, and the things that he really came to in about 1961, when he launched what he called his White Revolution.
That's right.
We felt that he was being restrained from doing those things, that he really wanted to do it, but that powerful interests were against it. Then he felt that he could be an example. At the same time, it was a little hard for him to convince people that he was on the up and up. in terms of these desires, because everybody knew he had a huge fortune. He had even a bank, the Bank of Iran, which was administering his fortune, and a Pahlavi Foundation, which he built as a Masonry Institute that really was more like management of his estate.
These are all things were known at this time.
Yes, they were well known.
Did you have much contact with educated middle class Iranians at this time?
Like, yes, a great deal.
Did they make any impression as to their sentiments about the system?
Yes, they were highly critical of the system.
What kind of people were?
There were many American educated technocrats, you might call them, in the government. They were doing their duty in the government, but they were quite quick to talk about what they thought was wrong. There were that kind of people. There were also other kinds of people in the government, very old-fashioned, obscurantist type people. One such became Minister of Finance during my time. I can't remember his name. He was an ex-military man, a very, very old-fashioned man. And he more or less sided with the Shah and mistrusted the bright, young, Western-educated bureaucrats and technocrats. We had a running problem with the Iranians. We came in with our .4 technical assistance programs, and the Iranians professed to like them very much, and certain classes of them did. But they were doomed to failure in a good many directions, particularly as regards things like land reform, tax reform, banking reform, because the posture of the Iranian officials was more or less to accept the technical assistance in principle and then just not do it. And a great deal of disillusionment occurred on the part of some of our very well prepared and very hard working technicians.
So it was .4 for administrative officials.
Yeah.
They were trying to present programs of banking reform,
yes,
currency reform and so forth.
And tax reform. The tax reform is the main one.
What was their objective in that respect?
Their objective was to institute. No, I didn't work on them. I was in the embassy, on the embassy side, but I knew the people who did, and they were very fine people. And I felt that often that they were being naive in thinking that the Iranian bureaucracy was really following their advice, and in the end they found that they were not, because they were trying to institute a progressive system of taxation which would tax the holdings of the powerful class, and there was no way that people who were running the Ministry of Finance could do that.
But they would be possible.
No, it was not possible under the prevailing system in Iran.
Fiscal reform as well,
monetary
reform, you said?
Yes. They were trying to do all of those things, and it was very difficult. Until the Amini period, when the Shah felt pushed in the direction of making reforms and felt that this was his historical mission, and reacted rather well. And I must say, at that point, the United States observers felt a great sense of uplift about the situation in Iran. This was what was going on mainly while I was Iran desk officer back in the States from 62 to 65, and it was a period of considerable optimism about the Shah's program on our part. There were then academicians who came to see us periodically. We had meetings with academicians who didn't agree with us at all, and who felt that we had made a great mistake in restoring the Shah in 1953, and even went so far as to suggest that we should put him out at this point.
Who were these people?
Donald Wilbur was one of them, and Manfred Halperin was one.
These are people who consulted on Iranian affairs?
There was a regular arrangement whereby they could come in and consult with the department. They, I think, was mainly their initiative. They wanted to do it, and we agreed to it.
I have some more questions on the 1950s before we get to the Iranian period. Seemed to be an Eisenhower administration, I guess late administration. He suggests sort of that the Shah had a legitimacy problem at home. What would be implications for U.S. foreign policy of this kind of problem if it were seen by embassy officials at this time? The sense of the sort of fragile basis for the Shah. Was that a great concern?
Yes.
It was talked about quite a bit.
It was a concern, and it was hoped that there was some way in which the Shah could establish himself as a more enlightened ruler so that he would have the backing of his country and that there wouldn't be any problems about instability. We didn't think there were great problems with instability at the time. We thought that there were enough checks and balances that the system could roll along for quite some time, but we nevertheless felt that there was an underlying fragility because it was not a popular regime. It was not a severely repressive regime at that time, the way it became in the 70s, but it was not a popular regime.
Were there concerns about repression among embassy officials?
Not so much of repression as there was concern. There was some concern among some people then and later about repressions of tribal peoples, and particularly of Kurds. But it wasn't felt that this was a central problem. I remember there was one CIA assessment, which we all thought was rather way out, in which it said that that if the two-day party, the Communist Party, and the tribals in the south, and the Kurds, and the dissidents in the northeast, who were Kyrgyz and people like that, whatever, all get together, that would be real bad for the Shah. We didn't see much chance of this happening.
This was just in the late 50s? Around 60 or something?
In the early 60s, I would say.
Yeah.
An assessment on the part of CIA, which we thought was overdrawn. As I look back on the press, it was not. But it didn't seem possible that there could be this kind of... they included the clergy in this, too. In other words, of all of the various elements who were who felt grievances against the Shah could make common cause, that this would cause a lot of trouble to the Shah, which is quite true. But we didn't see the possibility of such elements as the two-day party and the clergy and the Kurds getting together and making common cause. It didn't seem possible.
Were the ingredients they discussed, like Mossadegh's nationalists, or did they see that?
I didn't get
the Mossadegh supporters.
What about them?
Did they see them as a potential part of a coalition that could...
This was another one. I suppose when I said the two-day party, I was sort of including them, although that was too broad. That was,
how would you sort of characterize, as you saw it, say, Tehran, late 50s, 58, 59, maybe sort of 60, how would you characterize the Eisenhower administration's approach to Iran as you understood it? What's the general policy approach they took towards Iran and the Shah?
Obliged to the Shah. They after all, had been instrumental in helping him overthrow the Mossadegh threat, and they felt that they had to back him, that there was nothing else in Iran. And I think this is what my feeling was at the time, too, that there really wasn't any other viable force in Iran. That the Mossadegh, the great difference between us and the academicians that I referred to before, and there may have been others besides the two that I mentioned, was that they felt that the Mossadegh episode was more or less like the Nasser episode in Egypt, that Mossadegh was a genuine leader with genuine popular support and a viable one for the future, and that we came in, and because we couldn't see the way clear to solving the oil dispute, we engineered his downfall and put the Shah back in, that this was a terrible mistake. We thereby thwarted the Iranian nationalist movement, which was inevitable anyway, was due to come, and it was an awful mistake. We felt that the comparison between Nasser and Mossadegh was overdrawn, that Mossadegh was not that popular leader, that he did not have a real program, and that he was not a viable person for the future of the country, regardless of the oil situation. Of course, the oil thing was very, very important. I don't think I understood that myself quite clearly until such time as I reflected back in the late 70s and realized that the solution of the oil problem in Iran had led to some very fundamental decisions in the management of our own country. And I didn't realize really how important it was. I credit the vast shift of resources from public transportation to interstate highways to that point. And I can't emphasize in my own mind how critical and crucial that was. I can't overemphasize it. So I believe that perhaps there may have perhaps been an element of wishful thinking in our support of the Shah. It was understood that the Shah was, in many ways, until he launched his reform program, a weak reed, but it was not thought that we could have done it any other way.
Mm-hmm.
So you may know that there was a prime mover in this whole business of the restoration of the Shining, Kim Roosevelt. It would be very interesting if you could interview him. I don't know if he would allow himself to be interviewed. A very shadowy figure. But he certainly had a lot to do with it, and Alan Dulles too.
Did you get much of a speaking of...
And Lloyd Henderson, who was ambassador at the time.
Well, speaking of Colonel Roosevelt, have you seen a sense of CIA activity in Iran at this time, in the late 50s?
Oh, yes.
What things were 30 at the time that were going on that CIA was involved in?
CIA was, in many cases, closer to the Shah than our ambassador was. There was a station chief of CIA at the time, Colonel Yasevich, who was really very much a man in all streets as far as American policy and policy making was concerned. He had access to the Shah. He had greater access to the Shah than our ambassadors did. This was more or less condoned by Wales, but not by Holmes when he arrived. Holmes stepped in and curtailed it, I think, successfully.
What was this... What kind of results of the CIA influence the Shah, or assets the Shah had in terms of Iranian affairs? Was there any kind of influence?
I can't say what the influence was.
You weren't really involved in those discussions?
I was not involved in the discussions, but I have a hunch that the thrust of the contacts was to try to reassure the Shah and to keep him on an even keel, the hand-holding project.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't believe that any influence at all is exerted in the direction of reform or popularization of the government. I have no knowledge that this was part of the approach at all. I don't know whether that could be called cynical or what, but it was just maybe practical would be a kinder word.
So the short-term stability emphasis.
Yes.
Not a long-term view.
Yes. Now, I must say that our own was that way, too. And as matters turned out, it was also that way. We can say, looking back on it, as far as the 1953 action was concerned, but it did buy 25 years of stability, it was perhaps not for naught. And I don't think it could truly be said that it was the in and of itself the cause of the debacle in the late 70s, but it was not a long-term policy. It was not a policy of Olympian wisdom such as that which was urged upon us by the academicians. I don't know if theirs would have worked either, but
what kind of calculation of interest towards the American policymakers make? What was our assessment of American interests in Iran in the late 50s? What were the major considerations?
Oil.
You'd say oil was the predominant factor?
Yes.
Yeah. What about the strategic or political factors that accompanied the oil?
There were some. There was the, I would say, the recognition of Iran's, a certain connection of Iran with the Middle East problem. Iran being the only Muslim friend of Israel.
Uh-huh.
For a long time, the Israelis had an unofficial consul in Iran, and the Iranians took technical assistance from Israel in the matter of the development of the phosphate deposits of Lake Rezoye, which was something that the Israelis had regularly experiencing about because of their Dead Sea operations. And there was, in general, a rapport with Israel, which irritated Arabs a good deal. And as a matter of fact, Iran did not have a good relation with Arab states at all. The current war with Iraq is only the last episode in a long standing dispute with Iraq over lots of things. And there was not common grounds. Iran tended to take a dim view of Arabs. Iran might have made more common cause with Pakistan if Pakistan had been differently constituted. But the Pakistanis viewed Iranian overtures in their direction as takeover attempts because of Iran's superior wealth. So for example, it was the Pakistanis who were skittish about Iran.
This, all in all, do you think that petroleum was the bottom line interest, basically, in terms of the importance of Iran to...
I think so.
Yeah.
I think that the major interest was the solidification of the victory of 1953, namely the solution of the oil crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I would think so. Maybe I'm simple-minded about that, but I can't think of any other benefit later. There came to be another benefit, a rather Machiavellian one, namely that since Iran was getting a lot of money from us, and since we were beginning to have a balance of payments problems in the early 60s, that we should get the money back by selling Iran military equipment. This was the thing which I experienced when I was desk officer, and which I was very much opposed to, and was not completely unable to fight it because there was such powerful interest in our government pushing it, mainly McNamara.
Before we get to that, though, when you were on, you said you worked on petroleum issues once in a while in the late 50s. Did you get any sense that the sergeant companies had any kind of visible or active role in discussing American policy towards Iran or any other matters that they haven't seen? Did you see their influence on in any way?
A little bit. It was beginning then. I can't remember the exact year in which OPEC was started.
1951?
I think so. And when that started, the consortium began pressuring the United States government, particularly American oil companies, very much to keep the Iranians from pressing for price increases in oil. And they, particularly again when I was on the desk, I had a more overall view of policy when I was on the desk than I did when I was out there, because I was looking at everything and only partial things at the other times. The consortium companies, I can't remember which ones, I think Exxon was one of the major ones.
Exxon.
Caltex. Yeah, they pressed very hard on us to exert whatever influence we could on the Shah to make him desist from raising the oil price. And this, again, was small potatoes compared to what came in 73, as you know. But still, I did not feel that we had that kind of influence on the Shah, nor did I feel that there was any way, I didn't feel there was any way of convincing them of that. They would tell us to try to persuade the Shah that it was counterproductive, that the oil companies would stop doing business there, and this did not seem likely to us at all. So I don't think that they got what they wanted from us on that.
In terms of the Shah's initial role in OPEC, you know,
the Shah wanted to get as much money as he could out of oil. And there was hardly any way to persuade him not to do that. And nor did I feel it was sensible to try to persuade him. I think that there was some notion on the part of the oil companies that because of the Shah's gratitude toward us over the 1953 affair, that he perhaps was handing over some of his sovereignty to us, and I never believed this was the case.
When you talked to the Iranians, say, in the late 50s or 60s, say, did you get a sense that they were satisfied with the status quo in oil? Was there much discussion about
it? Yes. So far as they thought the price was too low, they were just satisfied.
That was the main problem. Mm-hmm. There was still not pressure. There was not much pressure on prices at this time, though. Was there oil glut in the early 60s, late 50s?
What was happening is that the major producers had formed OPEC, came together, and by cartel-type operations were able to do something about raising the price a little bit, control the production and raising the price. So this was kind of the wave of the future. It didn't seem to us to be terribly important at the time, but I remember that the Shah was then saying, at one point in the early 60s, he said that he was hoping that Iran's oil earnings would someday in the near future, in the next few years, approach $1 billion a year. Everybody thought that was really high in the sky. It was really amusing to think that by the time he actually, his regime actually came to an end, they were making what, about $50 billion, I don't know how much. They were making about $750 million in that time.
Do you get a sense of what the Shah's objectives were, what the Shah's goals were in terms of raising petroleum prices, what he wanted to do with that surplus income?
I think generally wanted to raise the Iranian standard of living, Iranian rate of literacy, Iranian welfare in general, and he genuinely wished to do that. He wanted his nation, he said in his dictated autobiography, and he said on many occasions to our people, that there is no honor in being the monarch of a poor, downtrodden, ignorant, illiterate country. And he wanted to be the monarch of a powerful, military, powerful, advanced, enlightened, etc. country. So he didn't want any democracy, did he?
So that's assumed that some of the income would go to Milton Armstrong or some sort of...
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah. To people in the United States, in the U.S. government, who cautioned him against spending too much on arms and neglecting his welfare programs, he would make the point that when the country had only one source of wealth, and that was already approaching $1 billion, he asked the question, did it not make good sense to spend at least part of that on protecting the source, this one source of income? He pointed out that the Arabs were very jealous of the oil. Most of the oil in Iran, as you know, is in areas contiguous to Arab countries. And at that time, the Iraqis were already taunting Iran. There were a great many Sunni Arabs in the areas where the oil was refined, at least, around the Abadan region. And they liked to refer to Khuzestan, which was Iran's main oil refining country and main oil producing, too, as Arabistan. And indicated they thought it ought to be liberated. And this the Shah used as evidence that his source of wealth was in danger, and the security is a fairly important problem for Iran. So this is what encouraged our people to look upon Iran as a good source of help for our balance of payments. There was at the time a very powerful and persuasive arms salesman in the Department of Defense named Henry Cust, K-U-S-S.
This is when you were desk officer?
Or yes. Or? Yes. Well, I believe he was there also when I started out in Iran. And when McNamara, particularly when McNamara took over the Department of Defense, Cust persuaded McNamara that this was the way they should approach the Iranian problem. And we did not think so, we on the desk.
So it's an export market for arms to some extent.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, and I particularly tried to use whatever small influence I had to avoid this kind of relationship with Iran. I thought it was not a good economic idea, not a good political idea either, and not good for our mutual relations. And I used to, my assistant secretary was M. Phillips Talbot, and I made that point to him all the time. One time he told me that he agreed with me, but that the secretary, Russ, had called him and told him that McNamara had called Russ and said he had heard that some of Russ's people were getting in the way of this arms sale that was so terribly important for the welfare of the United States, and please tell them to get out of the way.
That's very clear.
So, that was that. And that was about as, I could not go any further than that.
Where was that?
That would have been about 63 or 4. Mm-hmm. And at that time it was such small potatoes compared to what Nixon and Kissinger finally did, but it was really, really too bad. I think that that had a lot to do with the debacle in Iran, not so much the debacle in Iran, but with the complete debacle of U.S.-Iranian relations. It was a very malign development.
My small question is about that later on. Okay, we can pursue this later on. But you served with two ambassadors, Edward except Thomas
Wales
and Julius C. Holmes. How influential were they in the policy making process in Washington, or in terms of shaping the direction of American policy towards Iran? Did they have much influence or very much weight? Did you can see?
No, I don't think I don't think Wales was an original thinker by any means. I think he was a very fine man, excellent person, and a subtle person in many ways, and I think that he did what he could, but I don't think that he was a strong originator of policy. I think Holmes was perhaps more so. Holmes was even more intelligent and more devious and more, he kept his eye on what the relationship should be. But I believe that he went along pretty much with the thrust of relations, with the one exception of the arms sale. I don't think he thought they should be that high either. But he did not feel that we should push the Shah too hard toward reforms. At that point, he was running a terrific battle with a member of with the Kennedy administration in general. The Kennedy administration was very hard on the shop, particularly Bobby, and even after Jack's assassination, Bobby was. One of the principal authors, one of their principal advisors on that subject was a man named Kenneth Hansen, who had been chairman of the Ford Foundation Harvard group in Iran. Hansen was a self-styled liberal thinker and a mostly a pusher around of people, I would call him. And he got himself this rather influential job, a position in the Bureau of the Budget. I'm not sure exactly what that position was, but from that position he sniped at our policy with regard to Iran, particularly the policy of giving aid to Iran. He thought that we should perhaps squeeze Iran and thereby force the Shah into reform initiatives with his government. I think that he was rather a misplaced zealot myself. I don't think that that his views, if we had done them, that they would have come to much. And I believe also that it was a great embarrassment for anybody who was on the desk to have this going on in the first place. The Shah was well aware of it and impressed badly by it, and he was the one, well, it was not so much he, it was Bobby Kennedy who encouraged the anti-Shah students in their activities in the United States, which was a great embarrassment at the time.
That was, he,
Bobby Kennedy encouraged them.
And what was this, what did you hear about this, what's this new thing?
Robert Kennedy was very opposed to monarchs in general and to Shahs, and so was his brother. Robert insulted the Shah one time by scheduling a trip to Iran and then canceling at the last minute. Things like that upset the Shah greatly, any kind of personal snub. Then he met at a conference in Aspen in about 1962 or 3, a group of dissident students, some of whom were no longer students. They were well into their late 30s. One of them was Ghotan Sadeh, who became the information minister, who was the great supporter of Ayatollah Khomeini. And another one was Fatemi, who was the nephew of the only member of Mossadegh's cabinet who was executed, the foreign minister Hossein Fatemi. And these people had a meeting at Aspen, and Bobby Kennedy went out and endorsed them publicly. This was a source of considerable embarrassment.
Did the States probably have to intervene in that situation?
The State Department tried, but it was not very easy. Mm-hmm. The only thing the State Department was ever able to do, and I was personally involved in this, mm-hmm. was to call in Ghotan Sadeh and Fatemi, the two mm-hmm. ringleaders, and warn them, have the Director of Immigration and Naturalization, then a man named Ray Farrell, mm-hmm. warn them to cease their anti-Shah activities, or they would be deported because they were out of status. Mm-hmm. Now this happened, it was arranged well before the assassination, but the date was set after the assassination, December 1963. So they were very surly at this. I was present at this, and they looked at me and said, we know that you have been able to do this against our friends in the Justice Department only because Robert's brother Jack was assassinated and he's lost his power. Then, at that time, the only thing that we could do was to put a worldwide advisory watch on all of them as far as visas was concerned. Ghotan Sadeh tried, he left the country and tried to get a visa to get back in from Damascus and couldn't get in. So he was out, and that's when he joined the Ayatollah Khomeini in Baghdad. So that's the way that happened.
Well, this person, back to this, you mentioned thing about the Harvard group on Iran.
Yeah.
What was that all about?
This was an advisory group. Yeah. Yes, it was a Ford Foundation financed advisory group to the Planning Commission of Iran, Plan Organization they called it, the 5-year Plan Organization of Iran, to help them. It was a technical assistance project. And many of the bright, young, Western educated technocrats were in that group. And they had very, very good ideas, no question about that. I had some friends who were in that group, and Hansen was a leader of that for a time.
This in the late 50s and early 60s? Or
Hansen came in about 58.
Like this Ford, this group, this Harvard.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Besides ambassadors, who were the major players in Washington under the Eisenhower administration? The late 50s that were making policy in Iran, who were the influential people that you knew about working in the State Department? in Washington or National Security Council. Do you get a sense of who was making policy?
I'm not sure. I know that Dean Rusk, when I was back on the desk, did not have a very great interest in the subject. He thought that the foreign minister was stupid and said so after every meeting that he had, but then it was a man named Allah. He just didn't think much of it. Are you interviewing Iranians, by the way?
That's not part of the process. Through the American officials, the State Department, the
executive branch. Because I know some Iranians who are here who were involved in things at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another project, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any involvement or special knowledge of the discussions that led to the 1959 bilateral agreement with Iran, the defense agreement that was drafted?
No, that was the agreement which invoked the wrath of Khrushchev. I was mixed up when I said that it was the CENTO appearance. It is a bilateral because the Iranians had been pressing, as I recall, to the effect that CENTO alone did not provide them the sufficient security guarantees, and they pressed for this bilateral agreement.
Okay.